And tonight our speaker is Peggy from Los Gatos, California.
Thanks, Chris. I am Peggy, and I am an alcoholic. And I want to wish happy birthday to, about 9 birthday people. And I especially want to welcome the 3 newcomers that are here. And I guess that Scott, Jeff, and Jason, I hope you'll stay. And any visitors that might be here, you're welcome to. For those of you that are new, my job tonight is to share a little bit of my experience, strength, and hope, tell a little bit about what it was like and what happened and what it's like now. And your job is to listen. And with any luck at all, we'll both get done with our jobs about the same time. And if you get done before I get done, just raise your hand or make some sign, you know, anything. Because this is not something that I do as a career. I am not a circuit speaker. I'm here because I'm the mother of one of your members, and in honor of Mother's Day, I am here. John asked if I would come and speak, and I had to swallow really hard because this is way out of my comfort zone, but all you moms know that we'll do anything for our kids. So here I am. And another very important date is coming up this month. My AA sobriety date is May 29th, 1974. So for those of you who are math challenged, that means that I'll be having 30 years at the end of this month if I don't get hit by a truck between now and then, God willing. And I know God is willing. I'll go back to the beginning. I spent my childhood, I hesitate to say that I grew up in the Middle West, because I didn't grow up. I spent my childhood there. And I don't know if any of you have seen the movie Pleasantville. Hinsdale is very much like Pleasantville. And I say that in the most loving possible way. Pleasantville, the movie, was all in black and white because nobody in Pleasantville feels anything. They just go through the motions. It's like they're living in a movie, and they just go through the motions. And that's how it was. It was very nice, very pleasant, but it wasn't very real. And something inside of me knew that there was something there that didn't fit real well for me. And at 17, I really was ready to get out of Dodge. Luckily, I graduated from high school when I was 17, and so I came to California, and I've basically been in California ever since. And it was when I was in college that I met the man that I married and who became the father of our 5 children, and he bought me my very first drink. I think I was about 18 years old. And he bought me a rotten drink. It was bourbon and ginger ale, and I didn't much like it, luckily. So I didn't drink much for a while and was able to get through college. And it was a good experience. And we continued to see one another, and we got engaged like we did in those days. We got engaged first, and then we got married, and and then we started having kids, and then I graduated. But it was pretty much in sequence. But we did. I was still in school, and for my 21st birthday, and Joe took me down to our local watering hole, Chez Yvonne, down on El Camino, the bartender there, George, said, "Oh my gosh, it's your 21st birthday. Let me fix you a drink that you will never forget." And he made me this gigantic Beef Eater's Martini, and it was fabulous. It was love at first sight. I fell in love that night and stayed in love with gin for the next 25 years. It wasn't a smooth relationship. I'm very thirsty. I must be nervous. So we proceeded to have a lot of kids. This was back in, when we were married in 1949. That's a while back. And everybody then was having lots of kids. World War II had just ended, and we were trying to repopulate the earth as fast as we possibly could. And it was like a competition, having as many kids as we could. And we were going for six, but I ran out of gas. But it was one of those funny, sad things, because we were kids ourselves. And here, having come from Pleasantville, I had no idea. I had no idea who I was. I had no idea what life was. I had no idea what a wife was supposed to be, or what a marriage was supposed to look like, or what a mom was supposed to do. I didn't have a clue. I literally was clueless. And these kids just started coming. Chris was born right away, and then we had Ann, and then we had John, and it was like that, and we'd only been married 3 years at that time, you know? And it was exhausting. And the good news was that I found that if I had some of this wonderful gin, it really helped. It really helped. I have a couple of, I have a daughter, Ann, who has five kids, and she says, "Mom, how did you do it with five?" And I said, "Don't you remember?" And she, you know, I don't think she does, but the gin bottle would come out onto the kitchen counter in the afternoon when things started to get a little hairy. And the gin definitely helped get through the dinner hour and the crazy hour and the getting ready for bed, bath stories. Yeah, I was very mellow. In fact, I have it on good authority that there were times when I sang little songs and told stories and just had a very happy time, did little dances. And you know, the kids said, you were a happy mom. And the thing was that at that time I was. You know, that was, it worked. It was working. And that's the thing about drinking. It's a little cunning, baffling, and powerful that it works when it works for some of us. I think it's Dr. Gill that talks about how his drinking was characterized by the fact that it was fun for a while, and then it was fun and problems, and then it was problems. And so I'm talking about the fun time. And very gradually, there started to be some problems. And the main problem was that I got drunk. And I got drunk when I wasn't supposed to get drunk. You know, we'd have friends over. Joe was busy building a business, and I was busy building a family, and we had these friends, and we socialized on weekends. That was what we did. We'd work hard all week, and then we'd party hardy on the weekends, and we'd have these friends over, and I'd fix a really nice dinner, and then somewhere around about 8:30, I'd pass out. I went to sleep. Got very tired. And I went to sleep. I'd go back to the bedroom and go to sleep. And I didn't call it passing out then. I just said I was tired and I needed to go to sleep. Well, that got old really fast. And Joe said, "Well, you just can't go to sleep at 8:30 when you've got a house full of people. Jeannie had to serve dessert again last night or something." So it got to be these little domestic problems were arising. I wasn't able to be present for my family. And in hindsight, I can see that I really wasn't present for my family. But on the surface, the denial was still working, and it seemed like it was still okay. But I sensed something was missing, and I considered very seriously that maybe I needed to have some love in my life. Perhaps I needed to have an affair. Well, when you're from Illinois, from Hinsdale, the thought of that is so excruciating that you can't even bring yourself to get past just the thinking stage. So I immediately decided what I probably needed was a good fundamentalist religion. So I joined the Mormon Church instead. Try that drunk. I mean, that was great. I mean, I would get absolutely just blotto on Saturday night, walk into the church Sunday morning, the only person in the entire room who had ever had a drink in his or her life. I was noticeable. So that didn't last long. Needless to say, you can guess which one had to go. So I quit the Mormon church. But what was interesting about that, you know, life is so funny how the pieces kind of fit together after you have a long time to look back. I got baptized, and when I got baptized, I was told that the three older kids, they're 8, 9, and 10, they could be baptized now too. And I said, cool. So they were baptized too. Well, the boys were not at all interested in sticking in with it. They played a little basketball with the guys, but our daughter Ann stayed in the church, and she's still a member of the Mormon church all these years later, married a Mormon fellow, and they have a beautiful family, and the church works for her, and it works for them, and it's been a really, really beautiful thing for them. So I guess that was why I made the foray into the church back there, as I was frantically going down for the count. Well, since that didn't work, I got busy thinking, and you know how dangerous that is. So at that time, we had 4 kids, and what I thought was, when was I really, really happiest in my whole life? When has been my very happiest time? And I thought, well, it's when I have a new baby. So we had Michael. So Michael was born because I was going down for the count, and he was going to be my lifesaver. And so that little guy didn't have much of a chance. He was born for all the wrong reasons. But I was able to stay fairly sober, at least functional, for the next few years. And then things just kept getting worse and worse, and I was less and less able to hold it together. And finally, it was about, just before... I'm trying to get the sequence correct here. When Mike was about 7, his dad found it necessary to look outside the marriage for a little companionship, because living with the drunk was getting less and less and less fun. And he was obviously bored and restless. And so he found himself a lady friend. And at the time, I know he thought he was doing the right thing by telling me, because after all, I'm his best friend, right? And so he told me, well, I mean, you just don't tell this to somebody who's a drunk. I mean, I just didn't know. I had no coping skills whatsoever except a bottle of gin, right? So naturally, I just started drinking more. So the next 3 years, I just drank up a storm. From 1971 until 1974, I don't remember much at all. I don't remember who was president or if we were at war or what the kids were doing. The 3 older kids were off at college, and I think. But people would ask me, they'd say, well, gee, what's Chris taking down at UCLA? And well, just a general course, I guess. You know, I mean, that kind of stuff. And you know, if you knew me now, I mean, I am so I love my kids and so devoted. I mean, I know what they're doing. I know what my grandkids are doing. I know what my friends are doing. I know what my neighbors are doing, but I didn't know what my own kids were doing. So I was just really, really not present. And right before Mike's 10th birthday, Joe said, Peggy, you know, I love you and the kids, but I cannot live like this anymore. I'm going to have to leave after Mike's birthday. I'll be leaving. And I knew he meant it. We talked about it with his lady friend. We had talked about it many times. Get out! Get out! We all, you know, screaming. And, but, you know, this was real. I mean, this wasn't a screaming match. He just said it very calmly. I'll be leaving. And so Mike's 10th birthday came along, and I got very, very drunk. Not any more drunk than ever, but as drunk as usual. And Joe got drunk too, and we were fighting, and we were yelling, and we were throwing things out in the kitchen. And I forgot all about Mike's birthday. We didn't have a birthday cake. We didn't have a birthday party. I don't even know if he had a birthday present. He was just back in his bedroom all by himself, which is where he spent most of the first 10 years of his life. And his mom and dad were out in the kitchen drunk and screaming. Well, Mike came out of his bedroom somewhere in the midst of all this insanity, and he had tears rolling down his cheeks, and he looked up at me, and he said, Mom, I think you and Dad are both crazy. And I saw those tears, and I saw that pain, and I knew that somehow something was going to have to change. And I didn't know what it was, because I didn't know what the problem was. I didn't know that I was an alcoholic. I had no idea that I was an alcoholic. That thought had never occurred to me. You know, I knew that my drinking got out of hand once in a while. I knew I got drunk, but I didn't know that I was an alcoholic. And the next morning, I called AA. And it never, ever occurred to me to call Alcoholics Anonymous. Never in my wildest moments had I ever even thought about it. But when I saw Mike's pain, I knew that Joe was going to leave and someone was going to have to take care of this zoo. And if it was going to be me, I needed some help with my drinking. I wasn't coming here because I was an alcoholic. I wanted some help with my drinking. And the woman that I talked to at Central Office, you know, remember how people say, you know, that there's a wrench for every nut that walks in these doors? Well, Jane was my wrench. I mean, she was perfect. She listened to me, and she really heard me, and she ended up, after about a half an hour, suggesting that there was a nice little beginners group at Blossom Hill School. She could read me like a book. A nice little beginners group. How nice. You know, it was nice. And so I could go, you know, I could go. And I could have been some really hardcore bare light bulb meeting. You know, she knows that. She knew I would never go to this because I'd be scared. I was scared to death. Anyway, so I went to the nice little beginners group and I did not go in. I watched all you guys go in. And then I watched you come back out. I was terrified. It was about a mile from my house. I was afraid I might see somebody I knew. I still think that's hilarious. But anyway, it was. So, and I wasn't really sure. You all looked pretty nice to me and pretty clean and didn't look like alcoholics, I didn't think. I didn't know what an alcoholic was supposed to look like. But I had it in my head that I knew. So I called Jay the next day and said, I don't think that was the right meeting. And she said that was the right meeting. So I went back the following Thursday. And this time I did go in. But I was very well fortified. However, I did not drink gin. I drank vodka because I had seen on a billboard that Smirnoff leaves you breathless. So I thought I wasn't going to make the same mistake I made in the Mormon church. So I had a few stiff belts of vodka and went into the meeting. did not make eye contact with you, did not speak to you, did not identify myself, God forbid. And on my way out, a guy named Al McCoy walked over and he said, "The program works a lot better when we don't drink." And I thought, that son of a gun, how does he know I've been drinking? I purposely drank vodka so nobody could smell it. And I didn't breathe on anybody. So, but isn't that amazing? How could he possibly tell? Anyway, the miracles that keep happening, you know, the miracle for me is that I went back. You know, I wasn't humiliated and embarrassed and, oh, my God, the man knows. I mean, I just, well, okay, that's the deal. Okay, I'll drink after the damn meeting, you know, I don't care. So I went back the next week, and the idea was, of course, that I was going to drink after the meeting. That was my plan. I was full of plans. So what I heard was, I was just barely sober enough that I heard the magic words that night. We have a little guy in Los Gatos. His name is Eddie, or his name was Eddie. He's long gone now to the big meeting in the sky. But Eddie always said the same thing at every meeting. And that night he said, "If you don't take the first drink, you can't get drunk." What? I mean, this guy is brilliant. If you don't take the first drink, you can't get drunk? Holy Toledo. And then he said, "And we just stay sober one day at a time. And any idiot can stay sober for 24 hours. I thought, oh my God, I can't believe this. I'm so excited. I'm going to try this. I had never heard anything like this in my life. It did save my life. Those words saved my life, because I went home and I started not drinking the first drink one day at a time. Isn't that amazing? I had been drinking for 28 years. And I promised Joe, "I'll cut down, I'll cut down, I'll cut down, I'll cut down. I promise I won't do it, I won't do that. I'll never do it again." So here this little elf gets up and says the magic words. So I wish I could say that I stayed sober from that meeting on. I didn't. About three and a half weeks later, I decided I would take Mike over to see his sister, who was going to school at that time over in Hawaii. And now that our family was falling apart, I felt I owed Mike a little something special. So he and I went over to Hawaii. And, of course, during the course of our visit there, somebody, I certainly wouldn't have done it, but somebody put a carafe of wine on the table in front of me. And it looked awfully good. And here I am with my 3.5 weeks without a drink, and I'm getting real thirsty. And I see that carafe of wine, and I start to pour it into my glass. Now, I'm with my Mormon daughter, right, who has never had a drink in her life. She said, "Mom, I thought you weren't going to drink." And I said, "Oh, wine is food." Never thought that before that instant. I had never heard it, certainly, but that's what came out of my mouth. And so she said, "Oh, okay." So I drank a little food with my dinner that night. And as you know, when I got back to San Jose, my first stop coming home from the airport was the liquor store, and I bought my jug of gin, and off and running again. Luckily, I didn't have to run very long. I had been here just long enough to hear the magic words. I'd been here just long enough to get it that that I was an alcoholic, and that I just knew the party was over. I just knew that I had to come back. So that was in March, and in May I was back. May 29th, I came back, and I have not had to take a drink since that time. And it's been just an incredible journey. You know, I had a sponsor that she lived in on the streets of San Francisco. She was orphaned at a young age, tough as nails on the outside, but just a great big marshmallow inside. one of the most loving human beings I've ever known, but boy, she had a mouth on her like a mule, Skinner. I admired that. Because I had lived all those years in Pleasantville. Then I married somebody who didn't like to hear me use profanity, so I never was allowed to use profanity. And so I didn't. And then I met Joan. And Joan asked me things like, "Aren't you pretty pissed off that Joe ran off with that other woman after all these years?" "No," I'd say, "I don't get mad. I just get hurt." And then she would just let loose with a chain of expletives. And I gathered that she didn't believe me. And see, I didn't know. She said, "Honey, you're going to, if you stay sober, one of these days, that anger is going to surface. And I hope that you'll give me a call when it surfaces, because you're going to need help." And so I didn't really think that it was going to happen, because I was totally cut off between here and here. I hadn't had a feeling for so long that I didn't know that I had feelings, truly did not know. Well, after about 4 months of sobriety, I went back to the Middle West to a family wedding. Before I went, Joe said, "Do you think it would be okay for me to come on back home now? Looks like everything is better." And I said, "I don't think so. I don't think it would be a good idea." So I went to the wedding. When I came back, Joe's car was in the driveway. And my little heart just started going pitter-pat, and something was going on in my stomach, and I thought, "Oh my God, I think I'm having a feeling, and I think it might be anger." And I ran to the phone, and I said, Joan, and she said, "I think I'm mad," and she said, "Yay!" And so Joe had planned to just move back in. And I, you know, when you're a drunk woman, you just get to be a doormat, you know, and whatever they say, okay. So he just was used to me saying, "Okay." Well, I didn't know how to not say okay. I didn't know how to say no and make it stick. I had no idea how to do that. Well, he helped, because the next morning, when I was out in the kitchen, I was fixing breakfast for the kids and fixing their lunches. And he came out into the kitchen, and he said, "Peggy, I don't have any ironed handkerchiefs in my top drawer." And if you're sensitive, hold your ears, because I said a bad word. I said, "Iron your own fucking handkerchiefs." But that was, for me, a spiritual awakening. It was. It really was. I mean, I woke up to something inside of me that had been dead for a very, very long time. And it was, in my case, it was a very, very good thing. It was a good thing. I tell you, it was a whole new ball game, baby. It probably won't surprise you to learn that marriage did not survive sobriety. And I don't know if it's a good thing or a bad thing. You know, Joe and I were like oil and water. He's a good man, I'm a good woman, but we were like oil and water. And he's a much happier guy now, and I'm a much happier person. So I have to believe that it was the right thing, but it was tough on the kids. It was very tough on the kids. I remember Chris is here today, and I remember when I told him, he said, "Mom, it's like you're jumping from the fire pan into the fire, from the frying pan into the fire." And I said, "That may be true, honey, but I can't stand it in the frying pan one more day." And I meant that. You know, it was just my truth. So we split, and it was hard for a while, and I think it was very hard on Mike. You know, he had some hard times the next few years, but finally he was able to get some help, and I was able to get some help, and we all were able to work through our anger. And I'll sort of fast forward to 7 years of sobriety. I had a son that was, another son, that was trying to kill himself with alcohol and drugs. And I didn't know what to do because I didn't know what to say. I didn't know how to, you know, what to do. And by this time, I was working in the field. I know all of you, we love to work in the field. Well, I was working in the field, and I was working with alcoholics, and I had all the answers, but I didn't have the answer for my own son. And luckily, I was sent to Al-Anon. And in Al-Anon, I met a lovely lady named Lucy, and Lucy told me that God loves John more than you do, and you're going to have to ask God to help John. You've said all you can do, say, and you've done all you can do, and now your job is just to put him in God's hands. Now, I had been crying every night. I could hardly sleep because I really knew he was in bad shape, and I really wondered if he was going to be able to live long enough to get into this program. So that night, I went home from my Al-Anon meeting, and I got down. She said, just get down on your knees and ask God to hold John and take John's life in his hands just turn him over to God's care. That I don't know if I can do that, but I'll try. So I did. I got down on my knees, and I did exactly what Lucy had suggested. And I did that every night for about 3 nights until I got a phone call from John. He was calling me from Eugene, Oregon. And he said, Mom, I've been going to AA meetings, and I think they're going to work for me too. Now, I tell you, you know, when he had called saying that he was in trouble, I didn't even dare say much about AA. I just said, well, you know, go on over to the university. Maybe there's some counseling over there, or, you know, maybe there's someone that you can talk to, some shrink or something you can talk to. And then at the end, I said, and of course, there's always AA, kind of stuck it in. So when he called and said that he'd been to 3 AA meetings and he thought that it was going to work for him too, it was just like, oh my God, there is a God. And oh my God, he does love John. And he is taking care of John. Now, of course, if I'd known how really messed up John was, right, John? But the Jesco Club guys took care of John for those first few months, and it was a miracle, just truly a miracle. Anyway, it has been a journey. I've worked the steps over and over and over again. I'm one of those people that needs to work the steps over. I do work a lot in these last few years. I do a lot with step 7. I find that I don't need to go back to step 1 every time that my life gets out of whack, because I usually know that it's one of my glaring character defects that's pretty much wound into my hard wiring, and it's time for me to ask God for help again. So I spend a lot of my time on my knees asking God to help me to be less this and less that. Usually it's all balled up with my self-centered fear. My way of dealing with it is usually that I have to be right, or I have to know what's best, or something motherly like that. But it's been a growing time and a healing time for all of us. And this little Michael that was 10 when I was crashing and burning is now 40, and he's now married and has 3 kids. And 9 years ago, Michael and Laura had their first child. And They didn't know what it was going to be, a boy or girl, but they asked me if I would please come be in the delivery room with them, that they really would feel safer having me there, which was far cry from how things used to be. So there I was, and the baby was born. And of course, if you've been there in a delivery room, other than for your own delivery, it's really quite an experience. It's a very, very emotional experience, and we were all crying, and the baby was fine, and the doctor said, it's a little girl, and handed the little girl to Michael, and Michael was looking at her, and he took her over to Laura, and he said, Laura, she looks like a Margaret to me. They named their first baby after me. So, you know, you look back, all I could think, I was bawling my head off, all I could think of, here this little boy whose life was conceived for all the wrong reasons, whose first 10 years were a nightmare, whose heart I was breaking, you know, was big enough 30 years later to name his little girl after his mother. And that's the kind of stuff that happens around here. That's the kind of healing that happens in families. This year I had another milestone. I celebrated 75 years on the planet. And something to be, you know, to be impressed with. I'll tell you the way I was trying to kill myself. But I had a birthday party, and I had my kids come. And my kids all wanted to be there. My kids wanted to be at my birthday party, and my grandkids wanted to be at my birthday party. So we spent a week together down in California celebrating my birthday. And this is a woman who was doing her damnedest to tear her family apart, her marriage apart. I was totally not there for my kids. I was totally unable to be present for anybody. I did not care about anything or anyone. All I cared about was a bottle of gin. And as long as I had my bottle of gin, don't bother me. Don't get between me and my gin. And I joked about not knowing where my kids were and what they were doing, but it's not funny to me. And it wasn't funny then. You know, I was a mother who was guilty of neglect. I don't think I was ever overtly abusive, but neglect is a very, very real form of abuse. And those kids just didn't have a mom. And so I have made a decision. I made a decision a long time ago when I was doing my amends steps that I would be there for my kids whenever I possibly could. And I would be there for my grandkids whenever I possibly could. And that's something that I do on a regular basis, and I try to do that whenever I possibly can. I cannot make up for all those years that I wasn't there, but I can be there for them now. And that means a lot to me. You know, I really want to say to the new people, I do hope you'll stay. You know, this is such an incredible, incredible journey. This is, and this fellowship is such a warm, inclusive, welcoming fellowship that there is no way that you can possibly stay in here if you have any desire whatsoever to get sober and get well. There's just no way that it just won't happen. You don't even have to do much. In the beginning, all you got to do is just show up. You know, you'll say, oh, you got to do this and you got to do that. Well, my experience was that I just showed up a lot. My sponsor said, honey, did you drink every day? And I said, oh, yeah. And then she said, well, then you need to go to a meeting every day. And I said, oh, darn. You know, I just don't think I'm going to be able to do that. And she said, do you have pretty heavy social calendar, honey? Now, I had not been out of that freaking house for 3 years. How did she know that? I don't know. But she knew that. So she called me, as she always did, and she had me. So, of course, I went to a meeting every day. And finally, after about a year, I said, how long do I need to be going to these meetings every day? She said, are you still going every day? Why aren't you? So why don't you stay home with your kids once in a while? So, but you know, I don't think I did much of anything. She did want me to see what a real alcoholic looked like. You see, I still was she was sure that I didn't think I was a real alcoholic because I didn't know what an alcoholic was. And she gave me all the stuff to read, and she, you know, I went to meetings and heard people talking about it. But she wanted me to go downtown San Jose, go to the downtown fellowship, and hang out with the people who were living on the streets and who were the late stage alcoholics. And so I did that, and it was probably, for me, it was probably the very best thing in the world because I got to look at where the disease would take me if I did go back to drinking. And so in the course of doing that, I realized that I really, really loved working with drunks. I just loved these guys, these smelly old guys from the streets. I just loved them dearly, and they'd smile their big old toothless grin at me, and I just think I'd died and gone to heaven. You know, I really loved seeing them coming back and coming to meetings and staying sober, and that's when I decided that I had to work. I had to work with them full-time, so I got a job working with drunks, and I retired from that about 10 years ago, and of course now I just sponsor a whole bunch of people and greet new people when they come in and try to be nice to the old-timers who are cranky and grouchy. But I still love drunks. I still just do. And and this is where I've learned to practice the principles of the program. I've learned to be honest with you, and I've learned to be kind with you. I've learned to be, you know, to be able to show up and be present and keep a commitment and be there for you when you've asked me to be there. And I've been able to take those principles and use them in my home and in my family. When my mom was dying, she took a long time to die, and she was sick for a long time, and I made up my mind that I was going to be there for her as much as I could. Well, she was 2,000 miles away, and so I went back to Chicago and spent time with her as often as I thought I really could. And it was about every other month I'd go back and spend a few days. And while I was there, I was able to tell Mom stuff that I'd never been able to tell her, because she was still living in Pleasantville, God love her. And so, you know, I would give her big hugs and tell her I loved her and tell her how good, you know, my childhood had been and how important it was that she'd always been there for me. And she got so that she could actually hug back. And she could say, you kind of choke it out, "I love you too, honey." And so those kinds of things that I could do with my mom before she died, I learned here in rooms like this with people like you. Life's sad losers, the dregs of society. Ain't we the? I mean, it's just, isn't it something? And I mean, this is the last place I wanted to come to in the first place. And I've learned how to be a human being here. I've learned how to be a good, kind, loving, caring woman here. And I didn't know how to do that before I got here. So I've got this experience with Mom. I've got the experience with my kids and with my grandkids. And then coming up here and spending the weekend here with John and having dinner with some of his friends. It was just a joy to be able to show up. And so I think, as I said, if you're new and you're just not knowing if you want to be here or don't want to be here, you know, pray for the kind of despair that you get when you just simply know you can't do it by yourself. You know, I just can't do this. You know, I need help. And if you are at that point where you think you need help, you're one of the luckiest people in the world. And if you can identify at all with anything that anyone says when they share at an AA meeting, you're one of the luckiest people in the world. Because that's, I think, the glue that held me here. I started identifying with you. And you would tell me your story, and I think, yeah, I thought that. Yeah, I felt that. Yeah, me too. And it was like, it was just this heart language, this music that I just started hearing here. So if you're hearing that, know that you're blessed. And if you're not hearing that yet, stick around until you start hearing that. Because this will save your life. It'll not only save your life, it'll give you a life that you never dreamed that you might have. You know, I gave up that smelly bottle of gin, that bottle that was my higher power, it was my lover, it was my best friend, it was everything to me. And it almost killed me. And I finally was willing to give it up. And in exchange for that, I've been given the keys of the kingdom, right here, with folks like you. Thanks.